Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
And the time is exactly 29 minutes to the top of the hour. Don't forget, we go live to Cologne and Europe today. Right then, the clock and the camshaft. I have been looking forward to this since this first landed on my desk. The clock and the camshaft highlights the importance of medieval innovations as the basis for latter technological progress. It's a history of inventions focusing on the 11th to the 14th century, portraying vividly a thriving era of human ingenuity. Here to tell me more about it is the author of The Clock and the Camshaft, John Farrell. Good morning to you, John.
Good morning. Delighted to be here. Thank you so much for having me on the show.
And whereabouts on God's green earth are you this morning? Because it must be, I think you're in the States, aren't you?
Yes. Yeah. In fact, the sky is just starting to show some light here. I'm just west of Boston.
So it's some ungodly hour in the morning as well. So thank you for joining us this morning. This is a period of history that I absolutely adore. I think it's probably because I was raised on Monty Python movies.
But me too.
people tend to think of the Middle Ages as basically sort of, you know, robber barons and various kings and nobility, running around the countryside and beating up the peasants and having crusades left, right, and centre. But when you scratch past that veneer, it was a fascinating time of, as you say in the blurb, human ingenuity.
Exactly. It's, I think the fascinating thing is how, as you kind of mentioned, and it's kind of fun, we always think of like the rampaging and the invasions and, you know, the Huns and the Visigoths and all that, which did happen, of course, over the kind of slow rolling catastrophe of the end of the Roman Empire. But all along during those centuries, you had just the steady, you know, pick up and move on everyday people grabbing what they could that was left over from the Roman Empire, in specifically mill wheels, horizontal mill wheels, vertical mill wheels, to get on with the business of first feeding themselves and then realizing with adaptation they could use the same technology to make clothing, to make weapons, to start, you know, cutting stone, to build castles and churches and so forth. Again, all across several centuries, but it was kind of what was, I think, kept them going was let's make life better.
And one of the things as well, we're looking at the period here, aren't we? We're talking, say, the 11th to the 14th century. So that's sort of, you know, being British, we'll go from 1066, shall we? Because that's a note that every British schoolboy will know. So we're talking Normans and others as well. And, we forget, of course, the huge empire that the Normans had all the way from England through to Sicily, etc. And, of course, we've got Al-Andalus going on. I'm sitting to you in a studio on the southern coast of Spain, which was smack bang in the middle of the Caliphate of Cordoba, one of my pet loves.
Yes, exactly. It's one of the most fascinating parts of that time period, and not technically a technical invention. It was more a social invention. But what happened in Spain in terms of the scholastics and the medieval Europeans getting their hands on translations of works that had been lost after the fall of the Roman Empire. In particular, I would say Aristotle was probably the most important. They had like little pages of him here and there, but not his major works. And when the monks and the clerics started to go down to Spain, as the Spanish kings were reconquering it from the Muslims, their primary purpose was, geez, we need to get better astronomical tables so we can do a better job of, you know, predicting out years in advance what the date should be for Easter. And then they get down there and realize, oh my God, there's medicine, there's philosophy, all these books. So it just launched a whole program. And you mentioned Sicily, of course, the Normans, another translation movement at around the same time was taking place there from Greek directly into Latin. And this just had a revolutionary impact.
And I'm just loving the ideas of sort of roaming, not Roman, but roaming bands of translators. If you're like a dirty dozen, an Ocean's 11 of translators heading off with their quills going through manuscripts.
Oh, exactly. I mean, you can also almost imagine a Monty Python sketch about that. Well, you know, who got the physics of Aristotle? I didn't get that one. I got stuck with a cookbook, you know, something like that. I still have to translate it.
And also, yeah, because we tend to think of it as a very dour period and a very sort of grey period. But yeah, you talk about, you know, the libraries of Seville and astronomy and medicine, which, you know, the Moors, the Arabs had kind of already done the basework for this during this period of time. And the sort of stuff and irrigation and agriculture. So, you know, so it's not just that people dig in a hole. It's these complex systems of agriculture and industry that really, I mean, your book really does shed light on that and say, look, it's not what you think it was. You know, scratch the surface.
Yes, exactly. And a couple of things, very physical, environmental factors that played into this. And one was that the climate at that time really had improved a great deal. It was mild before the Black Death and the kind of mini ice ages followed. But in that period, I always think of Robin Hood. One of my favorite old movies was the Errol Flynn Robin Hood. And you look at it and think, okay, it looked like they obviously filmed it in California. It was all sunny and everything looks great. But actually in England, the time that would have been a fairly accurate depiction of the way the climate was then, because it was so mild, which is, of course, was excellent for growing more crops, feeding more people. And then again, to your point about the technology, the mills, Europe just has no end of water source power, rivers all through Europe. So it was easy to just say, hey, let's find a spot to build a new mill. And each little community, it started with the monasteries, of course, after the fall of the Roman Empire. But basically, every community would be based around probably like an easy source of power from water. And then later, wind, when you go to Northern Europe, later in the Middle Ages.
And also, we've got that, I mean, we have, you know, in ancient times, should we say, we have Phoenicians. You know, who I always think of those guys who got everywhere, you're not sure. They're sort of like, you know, the guys who head out from California in Volkswagen camper vans and you're thinking, have they been here or not? And those are Phoenicians because they keep leaving, stuff around the place. And you think, yeah, they were here. Carthaginians are pretty much the same thing.
Right.
And you got the Romans and there was that great expansion because you had galleys, et cetera, and slaves and the whole thing. So you could do a bit of exploring, shall we say, around the Mediterranean. But, you know, again, if I stood on my desk, two things would happen. A, I'd probably fall off, and B, I can see Gibraltar and the you know, the Pillars of Hercules from here. But communication took off, and the exploration took off. There were advances in shipbuilding. There were advances in navigation that had been stolen, had been appropriated from the Arabs, but they'd also been appropriated from the Chinese as well.
Yes. The compass in particular. And I'm not sure whether, I think it's still an open question for scholars, whether the compass, you know, made its way westward to Europe or whether it was just independently kind of rediscovered. But once you had a kind of a workable compass, you know, the merchants in Italy were now, this is great. We can go sailing in the winter and not be so much worried about losing our ships. We can go sailing at night. And that's when they really started to go beyond the Mediterranean outside and then down the coast of Africa. We tend to think to make the leap to Christopher Columbus and they went right across the Atlantic Ocean. But their focus really was kind of let's head south along the African coast and go around and keep exploring. But to your point, it was these kind of simple, not simple, but I mean, you know, breakthroughs that allowed them to kind of go way beyond where the Romans had gone.
And the camshaft. Now, if you have as much trouble with your car as I do, you know, trust me, it's a running joke on this station. But so explain to the not technically, stroke mechanically minded, where the camshaft came and what's that. Presumably, we're talking agriculture, light industry, I suppose you call it now. What did the camshaft then do?
It's the device that allowed mill wheels to do more than just grind grain. You take an axle. Basically, what the camshaft allowed you to do was to turn rotational energy into linear energy. And what that means basically is that you have an axle attached to the mill wheel and you put what I call fins on it. They're cams. Now suddenly you can use those as the axle is spinning to drive a forge bellows or trip hammers. And trip hammers will be could like pound cloth, you know, for weaving. They could drive saws to saw wood. So suddenly, and again, it was kind of an explosion. You could do more than just grind grain, which is important. Obviously, you need to be able to eat before you can do anything else. But you're using the same technology now to expand outward into making clothing, making weapons, making iron, even cutting stone, a particular kind of stone, to build even more reliable, robust dwellings.
So where do you, because you've divided the book into chapters for ease, if you like, of browsing or just getting into it, you know, give them hard, hit them fast with some facts, make it accessible. How do you then pick out the inventions that really, if you like, gave this period? And I'm going to call it sort of late Middle Ages, because what we refer to as the Dark Ages is the early Middle Ages. So what were the inventions? Obviously, as the title gives away, the clock and the camshaft are two of them in there. But where do you pick out the ones that make the grade, as it were?
I think the other one, one of the ones that fascinated me the most was in architecture, in inventing side buttresses so that they could build huge cathedrals, the ones that we're used to seeing. They'd kind of grown up or adopted, you know, the Roman Basilica, which is this kind of, you know, cross-shaped, a solid building, but really gloomy because the windows were tiny. And you literally do know, and this is rare, we usually don't know who is responsible for a particular innovation, but Abbot Suger, he was motivated by wanting to bring more light into church. So he was fascinated by how can we build with bigger windows. And the medieval architects were like, well, what we can do is we'll make thin walls, make them higher, and then we'll build these things outside the walls that will support those walls. And those were, you know, flying buttresses. And also the same thing, supporting heavier roofs with rib vaults. So again, they kind of moved away from, took a page from the Romans, but then kind of went them one better. But I think to your point, and you're correct, this is what they call the High Middle Ages, the, you know, 1100s. The clock came towards the end of the 1200s. And with the clock, what you have is for the first time, they kind of realized, well, we know how to use water energy. We know how to use wind energy. What if we could figure out a way to exploit gravity? You know, I mean, everybody, you know, we all know what gravity is because every time we fall, we feel it. And then intuitively figuring out a way to use weights to invent the clock. Now, they weren't thinking of time when they invented it. They were thinking of, you know, the bishop wants to automate the ringing of bells. And then once they came up with the device, the escapement drive, then they realized, oh, yeah, we can tell time now more reliably. And that had a huge impact on the later scientific revolution, because as I don't know if you've suffered through calculus classes like I have and so forth, you know, time is always a factor. But it wasn't until time could be quantified, literally tick-tock, that it became an actual thing that could, you know, be written down and then feed into and inspire science centuries later.
I mean, did you look at all anything to do with communications networks? Because this always gets me is the fact that we had these huge empires, you know, stretching through Europe. We had crusades, people taking off to Jerusalem to save their mortal souls and crusader states, etc. I'm always baffled about how on earth they managed to get the news back and forth.
Yes, it appears to be mostly on foot and on horseback. I had a little section there on something we kind of take for granted is, you know, with cars and being able to travel quickly. I think in those days, people just, you know, they were more used to walking, you know, long, long distances, you know, in groups, of course, you know, to be protected from being, you know, attacked by, you know, robbers and thieves. But yeah, no, communication probably lagged among all the other inventions.
And another one that struck it is one that, you know, especially as we grow more mature, we mature like fine wines, John, is eyeglasses. And I hadn't really thought of that before, but you don't see an awful lot of, I didn't really think about eyeglasses coming in that period. I thought it would have been, you know, 14 to 1500s, but they make an appearance.
Yes. Yeah. And it's interesting. It's an example of them solving a problem like, geez, you know, all these poor monks who are getting older, You can see the guy sitting there literally using a glass globe filled with water as a magnifying glass and rolling it across the page. And so you wonder how many hours it took him to read just three pages before someone figured out, hey, they're coming back from the Crusades and they got all these really cool crystals. Can we use the crystals to see better? And then you've got literally a guild of Italian glassmakers going to Egypt to getting natron and these other chemicals to improve their glass blowing, and then inventing spectacles all around the same time as the clock, a little bit later.
You see, this is the thing that I love. I mean, I was quite taken on, you know, gangs of roaming translators, but now we've got hand picked bunches of Venetian glassmakers heading to Egypt. I mean, when you deal with crystals, which they brought back from the Crusades. I mean, when you start on something like this, on a book like this, and you're dealing with it, because I, as you can probably tell, I love this period of history, but there are so many characters and it's such a rich vein of history that you start doing something, you know, boring, like, okay, we'll do something about a vertical mill. And the next thing you know, you're off on a side thing and there's a duke here. There's a painter there. It just, the whole tapestry comes alive.
Exactly. Exactly. And, there's also a great deal of, not friction, but people standing up for their own rights. For example, I mentioned earlier, the monasteries at the start became kind of the centers where the poorest people could go to get extra food because the monks were growing their own crops and so forth. But then you had a point where, you know, the individualists were like, well, we can make our own little mill and put it on our property. And then it's like, no, you have to come to the monastery and pay a fee to have your your grain ground. And then you see people saying like, this is really annoying because I can do it myself. Why do I have, and literally getting into not just tuffles, but like fights and executions about this kind of thing. So at the same time, you have people realizing, you know, that they can take command of their own kind of independent entrepreneurial ideas rather than have to kind of, you know, go along with whatever the ruling class is.
And this is another thing, isn't it? Because we have this, because when we look now, if we look at, you know, you look at the ruins of monasteries and abbeys and think that's, it all looks very quiet and contemplation and prayer and spirituality. But the monasteries and the abbeys were feudal, agricultural, military sort of hot. I mean, those were the main centers. They weren't just quiet. They were busy because people were farming. People were bringing stuff in. The people were, you know, wine, mead, etc. It was all going on in the abbeys and the monasteries.
Yeah, exactly. They kind of substituted in a way for cities during that whole period at the end of the Roman Empire before the merchant class in the later Middle Ages really took off and the cities began to grow organically on their own with the help of the universities, of course, which, you know, were all centered in kind of the major cities of Europe, Paris, Bologna, Oxford, Cambridge. But yes, yeah, the monasteries were kind of the focal point.
And another one, just interesting one, is paper. And we kind of think, oh yeah, well, paper's been around forever. But, you know, if we think about, you know, William Caxton and what happened next and the printing presses in Germany and then the pamphleteers sort of much later on in history. But, you know, a lot of it came from, you know, that this wouldn't have been possible. It's all very well having a printing press, but if you've got nothing to actually print on, then you're a bit stuck, as we'd say in British.
Right. Yeah. And poor Gutenberg, you know, he took a huge loan from a lawyer to do his printing press. And I think he printed like 1500 copies, huge copies of the Bible. He couldn't sell all of them. And he ended up losing the press back to the lawyer. And he spent the rest of his life, the poor guy, you know, working in obscurity for other printers. As to your point, yes, it was, again, Northern Italy, the mills there where they started cranking out I'm using the word cheap. It isn't cheap paper, but it was inexpensive paper. So now it was, you weren't just printing Bibles, which people did want to read on their own. You were printing, you know, account books for the merchants. You were printing pamphlets. And then novels, you know, arrived fairly quickly afterwards. You know, Cervantes, you think of him as a modern novelist, but at the same time, you realize, boy, he wasn't that far from the end of the Middle Ages when he wrote that.
And the thing is, though, with that, when you, because we're talking about these inventions, and we're thinking, yeah, that's the, oh, a clock, I can tell the time, you know, the crankshaft, etc. But, you know, you allow people to start printing and writing stuff, and suddenly the feudal lords, be it clergy or be it your local baron or whoever's got the castle at the end of the road, you're suddenly usurping their authority, aren't you? Because you'll suddenly be able to put down thoughts if you can write, of course. And that might not, as we say in 21st century parlance, that might not follow the narrative, John.
Oh, exactly. Yeah. No, the church was clearly alarmed by, and of course, the Protestant Reformation, again, followed fairly quickly after this because, you know, people realized, hey, you know, they've been telling me this and I'm looking, reading my own Bible and it says exactly the opposite. And, you know, why are we listening to these guys? So, but also, too, in the same sense of, you know, Galileo, as more and more people began investigating nature, they also began challenging the narrative of what they've been kind of given by the church. So, you know, Copernicus, Galileo, then Kepler and Newton, it kind of, you know, it moves on from there.
So what was your favorite of these, or was there one that you really liked, but, you know, it was a bit obscure? I didn't know the earlier Renaissance egg timer, for example. Was there something in there that did the court of Philip the Bad have a particularly nifty musical instrument you couldn't put in? What's your favorite one out of the, or what do you think had the biggest impact on, and you can draw a timeline from the early Middle Ages or from the late Middle Ages to now?
I think I'd have to say, I mean, the clock is what drew me into it as a subject for the book. But the thing that really surprised me was the invention of the universities, because it was a social invention, but it was a huge invention, all tied into the church's kind of systematic creation of law. And they didn't do it because they thought, hey, wouldn't it be great to have something like a university? Let's make it happen. The popes were thinking about, we need to protect ourselves from the encroachments of the secular powers. So we're going to build a body of law and base everything on that. Not realizing that, you know, once you have this idea of like a corporation, the cathedral schools would suddenly be like, hey, we can write ourselves a charter. And now we're an independent institution. And, you know, don't tell us what we can and can't teach. Of course, the church tried to do that. But that's another kind of, you know, source of tension that had all sorts of creative, really productive, revolutionary things down the road. So that was probably the thing that surprised me the most, that kind of key between the legal and the educational institutions.
What do you hope that people will take from your book, The Clock and the Camshaft? Presumably, you'd like it to be a starting point for a whole new audience to get to know and love the Middle Ages.
I think the thing that inspired me the most as I researched and wrote it was to what we mentioned at the beginning, just everyday people, you know, with their own ingenuity, using their hands, focused on making life better. And over the course of time, creating all these things without which, you know, we couldn't get along. And, you know, I came at it from the point of like the scientific revolution, but we always think of that in terms of purely intellectual ideas. But those ideas wouldn't have come about had they not had this kind of, you know, foundation built in place, especially, as I mentioned before, like clocks. You know, there's such, you know, time is such a key element to science in the abstract. So, what really inspired me, and I hope people get out of this, is the sense that all these people we'll never know. We don't know their names. We don't know who they were. They've come and gone. And yet they built these things again, these things we can't live without. That, I think, is for me, I hope, what people take away from it. It's just that ingenuity of everyday people.
See, we covered all the bases, from flying buttresses to millstones to teams of roving translators, and now the Venetian eyeglass manufacturers. It's a fascinating read. It's called The Clock and the Camshaft. It's by John Farrell. John, if people want to find you online, and it's also an audiobook as well, I believe, as well, isn't it?
Yes, so, it is. The audiobook just came out. Yeah.
Wonderful. But if people want to find you on the socials, I know you're on the Twitter, because I'm looking at it now. Where can they find you on the internet thingy, which isn't, I believe, last time I looked, a medieval invention, and it would have been much better if it was.
I have my own website, which is basically my last name with media, so farrellmedia.com, and that's where I have all my books and my freelance articles and so forth. That's probably the easiest place to find me.
John, it's been brilliant to speak to you this morning. I've been looking forward to it. Thank you for getting up so early, and thank goodness for the clock, as the saying goes. The book is called The Clock and the Camshaft. It's by John Farrell. Please go and check out Farrell with two L's media, and two R's indeed, farrellmedia.com. You'll find that, and also if you go to our Twitter feed, you will find a link to him, and you will find the book as a virtual download from our own website. John Farrell, thank you so much for your time today.
Thank you so much. It's been a pleasure.
Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen, brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at lower.com field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and Leon starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at columbuscrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.